This is the Get Healthy 360 podcast, where we discuss topics related to your physical, mental, financial, and spiritual health. Your host is Dr. Chris Ferguson, board certified in anesthesiology and pain management. This podcast is for informational purposes only, and you should consult your primary health care provider before making any decisions related to your health. And here's your host, Dr. Chris Ferguson. Oh, one more thing before we start. If you like this episode, please consider rating us 5 stars. We would really appreciate it. Thanks very much.
Welcome to Get Healthy 360. Today we have with us again Dr. Fyodorov. We're talking about tension headaches. What we'll talk about is the pathophysiology, or what causes tension headaches. We will get into how do you diagnose tension headaches and the treatment for tension headaches. So Alex, thanks again for taking the time for this podcast.
Thank you, Chris. Happy to be here.
So what is a tension headache?
So tension headache is one of the most common primary headache disorders. So statistically, in terms of prevalence, this is by far number one, the most common, the most prevalent headache disorder there is. There have been several studies done that looked into the prevalence and the, you know, kind of how common this type of headache is in population. And there's some evidence that at least 50% of people experience headache on, maybe not on a chronic or regular basis, but they know what tension type headaches are. They've experienced them. Some other study shows that over 70% of people experience tension type headaches. So this is something that extremely, extremely prevalent.
And what causes tension headaches?
We still don't actually quite understand in details and in full depth the mechanisms, the pathophysiology of tension type headaches, either chronic or episodic. But as the the term tension type headache, it means that it comes from some sort of tension that could be physical or emotional. In fact, we used to call tension headache as a stress headache because we found that emotional stress, sometimes physical stress, play an important role as far as the triggering tension type headaches. So in a nutshell, it could be many, many factors that could bring on tension headaches. And some of those factors are very closely kind of interlinked with migraine triggers. So for instance, physical and emotional stress, we see that being a trigger in migraine headaches, and it is appears to be a very strong trigger in tension type headaches. And some patients experience, for example, lack of sleep, or disrupted sleep, dehydration, feeling hungry. Those kind of things are very commonly bring on tension type headaches. But as we talked previously, the same triggers could actually bring on migraine headaches. But it doesn't mean that tension headaches is the same headache with slightly different clinical features as migraine. They're actually quite completely different really conditions in terms of their impact on patients' quality of life.
So this is more of a medical question, but how is the pathophysiology of migraine headaches different than tension headaches?
Well, first of all, when we talked about migraine, we mentioned that very potent, very famous now, neuropeptide called calcitonin gene-related peptide, or CGRP. We don't have any evidence to suggest that CGRP is involved or involved as much in patients with tension type headaches. So in fact, pathophysiology, the mechanisms behind the tension type headaches really depend on whether we're talking about chronic or episodic tension type headaches. And just like any other headache disorder, we classify tension headache as being chronic if patients experiencing headaches on more than 15 headache day or 15 or more days per month for at least 3 months. As chronic tension type headache, episodic would be less than that, so less frequent. So the mechanisms for episodic tension type headaches, we typically consider those being peripheral, meaning that it's usually increased myofascial tenderness or muscle tenderness pericranially, so in the frontalis muscle and temporalis, occipitalis, paracervical muscles. And in fact, that increased tension in those muscles, so myofascial tenderness, has been noted not only during tension type headaches, but also in between tension type headache episodes. And that led scientists to believe that this increased myofascial tenderness is actually the cause rather than an effect of the tension type headache. There's some evidence that patients with tension type headaches experience higher prevalence, if you will, of trigger points formation in the pericranial and cervical muscles.
So for anyone who doesn't have a medical background, what is a trigger point?
So trigger point is a focal area of increased muscle tension, if you will. So the muscle fibers, the muscle, you know, the muscle itself could be in increased can be in a state of increased tension. So the tightness of those muscle fibers is increased. And then within that tight muscle, there are certain areas with extreme tightness, to the point that actually they form those, so to speak, knots that are very, very tender. And when we press on this knot, it feels extremely sharp in pain. Now, a patient would feel extremely sharp pain, and that's why we call those trigger points, that they trigger a painful response to even non-painful stimulation sometimes. So those are the focal, I guess, again, areas of the super increased muscle tightness within the muscle fibers. So if we look at the prevalence of those trigger points, we certainly see them more often in patients with tension type headaches. And we see them not only in the pericranial muscles, again, like in the forehead region and temporal region or occipital region, but also in the muscles in the neck. And that has been compared, again, with people without tension type headaches, and the prevalence of this trigger point formation is nearly not as often. So that's the kind of partial idea, I guess, of the mechanism behind the episodic tension type headaches. With that being said, because that has been proposed hypothesis that's been kind of alive for many, many, many years, there are some studies done that look into the, you know, different techniques to measure this tenderness, to measure this tightness, if you will, or activation of those muscles pericranially. And some studies use so-called EMG, it's electromyography study. And those actual studies revealed that there's an increased activity of muscle fibers, if you will, which is a reflection or equivalent of muscle activation and muscle tightness, so to speak, kind of indirectly. And that increased muscle activity was noted only in 50% of the patients. So which was sort of a surprise, because we thought that it's going to be almost universally elevated in all patients studied, and that was not shown. And again, it could be due to researchers using different recording techniques. There might be some patients' variability. So there's some, you know, some deviation from standard of care, if you will, as far as the EMG-guided analysis. So there might be some deviation based on the technology or technique that was used. Another thing that sort of came to mind, because we're still, even when the EMG didn't really show that the muscle activity has been increased or elevated in all patients, but only in 50%, we still sort of try to analyze this pathophysiological component a little bit further, because it feels very, I mean, almost all physicians feel very strongly that there has to be something to do with this increased muscular tightness pericranial, that that's what's causing the pain, because ultimately that's what our patients experience, and that's how they describe this pain. They feel as a tight band around their head. So it's a very, very kind of interesting clinical phenomenon. So the other speculation was that due to this constantly increased muscle tightness and constant hyperactive motor neuron, or the motor neuron unit, so to speak, that there's sort of development of local ischemia from all this muscle tightness. And as a result of this constant ischemia, lack of blood supply or deoxygenation of the tissue, there's a release of inflammatory mediators, inflammatory peptides that sort of stimulates the peripheral receptors, producing that constant nagging, dull pain. But yet, again, we looked, so there are ways how we can actually analyze the presence of that ischemia or decrease, or the ischemia is basically a situation when there's a decreased blood supply, decreased blood flow to certain parts of the tissue. So sometimes scientists can do this little microdialysis study when they actually can assess the prevalence of certain inflammatory markers, inflammatory mediators, and lactate within the muscle fibers. And there was at least one study that I'm aware of that was attempted, and yet it failed to demonstrate an increase in lactate or any other inflammatory mediators in this muscle. So there's a lot of questions about, you know, what's really going on and how, and what's causing the tension type headaches. But ultimately, again, it's everything what we just talked about. This is involving just peripheral mechanisms or peripheral structures like pericranial muscles. Everything that was studied was kind of within this outside, most superficial layer. With central, with chronic tension type headaches, we believe there's a central mechanism when it's not only peripheral structures that are involved, but actually a central nervous system is involved. And one of the, not mechanism, but one of the features, I guess, one of the features that we observe in patients with tension type headaches, the same ones that we observe in patients with migraine, is so-called the allodynia, pericranial allodynia. When patients experience painful sensation to non painful stimulation. So usually it would affect pericranial structures, again, like skin in the face, on the scalp. When we touch the scalp or touch the skin in the face, and patients feel very uncomfortable, unpleasant, even painful sometimes. And that allodynia is usually, it's a phenomenon described in the context of central sensitization, when there's a increased sensitivity and decrease the pain threshold in the peripheral nociceptors or pain-sensitive receptors. And we observe cutaneous allodynia in patients, with chronic tension type headaches, but not as much in patients with episodic tension type headaches, but only in chronic tension type headaches. And again, that was also found to be in between tension type headache episodes. And that again led us to believe that central sensitization is something that sits at the core of the pathophysiology of chronic tension type headache. So I think that as far as a tension type headache is concerned, we still have more questions than really answers.
So it seems like it's confusing to a lot of people, including myself. How do you differentiate between tension headaches and migraines? Because there are a lot of overlapping symptoms. So if you can discuss some of the, I think, how would you make one diagnosis over the other?
So this is actually a great and very clinically relevant question. This is one of the more common, I think, misdiagnoses that we see in patients with migraine headaches. So I do feel that a lot of migraineurs should have been diagnosed as migraine patient as opposed to tension type headaches. And yet, because of this really significant rather overlap, sometimes it's very difficult to kind of to pull these two diagnoses apart. And because treatments typically are very different, obviously the outcomes will be different depending on how we treat this patient. So both conditions are fairly prevalent. But I would probably, would put it this way. If a healthcare provider sees a patient in their office who came to see a doctor because of the headache, it is very likely, more likely to be migraine than tension type headache. The reason being that tension type headaches are almost never severe. In terms of the severity scale, they're almost never severe. They could be unpleasant. They actually could be quite disabling. There's some studies done that looks into a really impressive disability related to chronic tension type headaches. But not ultimately, as a single headache episode, tension type headaches are not as disabling as migraine, so to speak. As far as the other differences, and you know, it's kind of interesting. Some experts believe that tension type headache and migraine, if you draw this kind of little kind of line, a long line, so migraine would be sitting at one end and tension type headache would be sitting at the opposite end. So it's sort of kind of different ends of the same continuum, and that tension headache and migraine, they sort of kind of float along that continuum and can go into one state or another. And yet pathophysiologically and clinically, there are actually significant differences between this condition. So how do you differentiate? As I mentioned earlier, migraine, it's usually moderate or severe. Tension headache is usually mild or moderate. So I guess if you have a patient with level of pain of 5 or 6, it actually could be either or. Duration of tension type headaches also varies dramatically. As you remember, migraine headaches, we talked last time that it could last between 4 hours and up to 3 days. Tension type headaches could last from 30 minutes and up to a week. And usually it's kind of this nagging, lingering, kind of dull, usually squeezing or pressure-like sensation that patients experience. Usually, again, migraine would be more throbbing pain. Tension headaches would be more dull, pressure-like sensation. As far as location of the pain, I mentioned previously that migraine, again, classically from a textbook style, is usually unilateral pain, but not always. Tension type headaches is typically pain bilateral or located bilaterally. That usually involves the forehead, occipital region, temples, kind of, and more often than not, patients describe tension type headache as this rubber band that kind of circles around their head, or very as if they're wearing a very tight hat that's kind of squeezing from the outside in, and that's the typical presentation of a tension type headache. Migraine, again, usually it could be bilateral pain, but it's usually more of a throbbing nature or aching, and it certainly usually tends to be a little bit more severe. Another, I think, really important differentiating factor that for some reason we don't always pay attention to or ask, but in my mind, this is a really critical feature, is headache-related disability. So for example, if you remember, we talked about migraine patients, they typically prefer to stay in a dark, quiet room, take a nap, lay down, and just kind of call it a day. They want things to be slowed down because they can make themselves work, obviously. They can push themselves to function. But usually, if they have an opportunity to call it a day, they certainly would, because pushing themselves functioning makes the pain even worse. Many patients with migraine will tell you they can't do even routine activity, like going up and down the stairs, you know, washing dishes, laundry. This is not something that patients with migraine would be able to do because it will make them feel worse. The patients with tension type headaches, from the other hand, they actually don't experience this much disability in terms of the, you know, inability to tolerate routine activities. And in fact, patients with tension type headaches frequently would prefer to stay active because possibly distracting themselves, possibly, you know, activating other pain coping strategies and skills, but they prefer to stay active because it actually makes them feel better. And this is something that is strikingly different when comparing with migraine. So patients, again, with migraine, they avoid activity. Patients with tension type headaches, they actually don't avoid activity and frequently want to be active. Another interesting thing that patients with migraine typically experience nausea and vomiting, not maybe vomiting all the time, but nausea is a very, very prevalent feature. It affects about 70% of patients with migraine. Vomiting wouldn't be as prevalent, but also patients with migraine experience sensitivity to light and noise. Patients with tension type headaches, although they can be sensitive to light and noise, they're typically not feeling nauseous or very, very rarely. And certainly they would not experience a vomiting. So in other words, if you have a patient who you would think has bilateral pain and it's kind of very vague description, maybe like a dull, maybe some aching, not particularly throbbing, and it's bilateral, but patient sensitive to light and having vomiting, without a doubt, that probably would be migraine and not tension type headache, because vomiting is a very unusual feature. It's actually never been described in patients with tension type headaches. So those are would be probably differentiating factors. So the most important probably is not really the severity of the pain. It's not probably the location and the quality of the pain in terms of throbbing or pressure, like, but it's really presence or absence of nausea and vomiting. It's presence or absence of headache-related disability and avoidance of routine activities. Those are the things, three features or three questions that we need to ask our patients when we're trying to separate whether it's a migraine or tension type headaches. All other features could really be overlapped, and it's going to be really, really hard to really differentiate these two conditions based on just severity of the pain or frequency or the way patients describe the pain, whether it's being pressure-like or throbbing, for instance.
So you've given a ton of information. So I'm going to see if I can summarize it and then correct me where I'm sure I'm going to misspeak. So the migraines are really caused by neurogenic inflammation causing blood vessel changes in the brain, whereas tension headaches are more of almost a muscle spasm, muscle inflammation, tenderness on the outside of the brain.
Correct.
And then the diagnosis, migraines, people, the hallmarks really, patients really just want to lay still, mm-hmm. nausea, and disabling, whereas tension headaches, typically bilateral, they can get up and moving around, but it can still be disabling.
It can be disabling, but not to the point when patients would say, you know, I need to call it today and lay down. Actual patients would prefer to stay active. They can work easier than patients with migraine. Migraine patients, I mean, they only make themselves work. They only make themselves to function. Tension headaches is not as much of an effort. It's more like, should I work or shouldn't I work today?
And did I miss anything with that summary?
No, I think it's pretty spot on. Again, the pathophysiologically, there's some overlap, but you're right. So migraine is more of a neurogenic inflammation, so to speak. It's the more of an imbalance in the certain neuropeptides and neurotransmitters like CGRP. In tension type headache, there's a peripheral mechanism that we see in episodic tension type headaches. And there's some central sensitization evidence of central sensitization in patients with chronic tension type headache. But yeah, ultimately it's more like peripheral versus central nervous system involvement.
So because of that clear difference in the mechanism, meaning muscle spasms versus the neurogenic inflammation, so what are some of the triggering things other than stress that would cause tension headaches? Because with migraines, to review, migraines are caused by the tyramine or that, you know, like wine, chocolates, cheeses.
Correct. High tyramine containing products. Correct.
So what are some of the triggers or things other than stress that would cause tension headaches?
Well, first of all, it could be dehydration. It could be lack of sleep or irregular sleep pattern. It's skipping meals frequently. Those would be common triggers for tension type headaches. But then again, those that seems to be not very specific for tension type headaches, as exactly all of those things that I just mentioned could also trigger migraine. So in that sense, trigger-wise, it's not very useful to sort of learn. Knowing what the triggers are is really important from the treatment standpoint, from the therapeutic standpoint, but probably not from the diagnostic standpoint. So for example, if you have a patient who says, well, if I don't get enough sleep or my sleep is irregular, that's when I typically get more headaches. Well, that could be seen in both migraine and tension type headaches.
So what are, so we talked about, again, to compare and contrast, you talked about avoiding food triggers, the acute medications for, to treat migraines. And then you also talked about the prophylactic medications for migraines, and you talked about the CGRP as well as Botox for migraines. What are the treatment options for tension headaches, acute and chronic?
Right. So basically, there's actually quite a few things. So if we talk about acute, first of all, as I always mention, that acute therapy, if patients experience headaches, everybody should be on acute therapy. But not everyone should be on the prophylactic therapy. It really depends on the, first and foremost, on the headache-related disability. And second is headache frequency. So as far as acute treatment, so essentially because tension-type headache doesn't appear to be as severe in terms of the, its intensity as migraine, most of the patients typically would deal with, even with tension type headaches, even by using over-the-counter medications such as acetaminophen, aspirin, ibuprofen, and other NSAIDs essentially. Some patients might even benefit from adding of addition of caffeine. That's when things, again, get really, really closely mixed up with migraine treatment approaches, right? But again, in migraine patients, Tylenol and aspirin are not going to be nearly as effective as opposed to tension type headaches when this treatment actually can control the pain. So migraine patients, I typically tell my patients, if Tylenol or aspirin work for you, well, great, good for you, but this is not the pattern that we see majority of the time. So tension headaches, again, they respond better to over-the-counter therapies. And in fact, if we're looking at the, for example, if you look at the European Federation of Neurological Society guidelines that they published, I believe, in 2010, they actually put the level of recommendation behind some of those medications. And for example, things like Tylenol or acetaminophen and aspirin and ibuprofen, all of these medications have level A of recommendations. So meaning that they're very effective and it was proven to be effective. You know, we see the same results with naproxen. We see the same results with diclofenac. Caffeine, again, doesn't have as much support. It has level B evidence. But again, it has there have been several studies indicating that this type of medication, or at least medication with addition of caffeine, might have some added benefit for patients. What's really interesting about tension-type headaches is that we've been talking about as increased pericranial muscle tenderness and tightness is one of the mechanisms, one of the pathophysiological mechanisms of tension-type headaches, certainly episodic tension-type headaches. There's really no strong scientific evidence to support use of muscle relaxants. It doesn't mean that we don't use them, but ultimately, we don't have really any strong evidence that would suggest that muscle relaxants are certainly effective. And this is something that goes, again, against our understanding of the pathophysiology of tension-type headaches. In my practice, I certainly use a lot of muscle relaxants, but I do that for a couple of reasons. First of all, I do believe that patients can take certain muscle relaxants safely for an extended period of time on a regular basis without cause of rebound headache or medication overuse headache. There's no evidence that muscle relaxants can actually do that. So, and a lot of patients, especially those who experience frequent headaches, I would rather them take a muscle relaxant, especially if it works, rather than, let's say, an NSAID or an acetaminophen, because both NSAID and acetaminophen can actually contribute to medication overuse headaches.
So there are a variety of muscle relaxants. Which muscle relaxants would you say are in your preference list, and which ones are less on your preference list?
So I've used actually probably all of them. It really depends on the severity of the condition and how patients respond. I can't say that they have my favorite, for instance, muscle relaxant, but I certainly have, for example, I have a group of muscle relaxants that I typically use for younger patients or for older patients. And those would be the medication that would produce less sedation, less fatigue. In my mind, by definition, muscle relaxants are sedating until proven otherwise, or at least they can make you feel tired, let me put it this way. Not all of them are sedating, but almost all of them can make you feel tired. So if we're dealing with a younger population of patients who are mentally and physically active, they have to go to school, they have, you know, they're studying, they're doing things, we certainly don't want them to feel tired and exhausted all the time from this medication. So I tend to use less sedating or less fatigue-provoking muscle relaxants, such as baclofen, for instance, is one of the drugs that I use a lot for that specific reason. For that same reason, by the way, baclofen is considered to be a muscle relaxant of choice for elderly patients when we're concerned about risk of falls and drowsiness and sedation, because typically elderly patients are more susceptible to this particular side effect. So baclofen, again, is considered to be a drug of choice or muscle relaxant of choice for elderly patients.
Are there downsides to baclofen?
Not really. I mean, baclofen is actually, it's one of the older muscle relaxants. It's been around for a long time. It does actually have a fairly strong muscle relaxing effect, and sometimes it actually has almost an independent pain relieving effect. Mechanism of which is not really fully understood, but we use this particular muscle relaxants in some of the patients with neuralgia type of pain, when there is a nerve pain essentially, and baclofen sometimes can help with that. Downside, again, outside of the drowsiness and sedation, there's very, very little. Again, this medication has been around for a long time. It has been used in multiple shapes and forms. It's obviously what we use right now. This medication is a tablet form, and it comes in a variety of different strengths, and the therapeutic range is rather broad, meaning that, and I actually like this part about baclofen, because you can start somebody who's very sensitive on a super small dose, as little as 5 milligrams even, which is a half a 10 milligram tablet, and can go pretty high. You can go up to 40 milligrams at a time in some patients. And baclofen in neurosurgical practices and some pain management practices, they use baclofen intrathecally through the intrathecal pumps to treat really severe cases of severe spasticity in patients. So just gives you this idea how potent this medication can be, and there's a variety of ways how it could be administered, obviously.
It is interesting that it seems, at least in my experience, the primary care physicians that I work with, their go-to muscle relaxant is Flexeril, which I found to be extremely sedating.
And that's my experience as well.
It's rare to see a primary care physician write for baclofen.
Right. And I'm not really sure that I understand this sort of approach, because I do think baclofen is one of the safer muscle relaxants, and it's been tested with time. And it doesn't mean that other medications or other muscle relaxants are less safe per se. But again, baclofen, it's been a standard of care for decades, literally. And it's one of the muscle relaxants, the only muscle relaxant, we can actually infuse intrathecally directly into the spinal fluid. Again, that tells you something about the potential toxicity of this medication, which has to be pretty low if you're allowed to infuse it into the intrathecal space. I do use cyclobenzaprine as well. And I wouldn't say that, you know, as far as the muscle relaxing effect, I think all of these medications are fairly potent and they're equally effective. It's just that you need to find the right muscle relaxant for the right person. But as far as the sedation, I certainly think that cyclobenzaprine, in my experience, would be more sedating, more fatigue producing than, let's say, baclofen. Cyclobenzaprine is a great drug. There's actually an extended release cyclobenzaprine. The brand name is called Amrix, which comes as 15 or 30 milligram dose, essentially, you know, that patients could prescribe once a day, typically at night. I do use this muscle relaxant actually quite a lot, simply because the problem in patients, maybe not in patients with tension type headaches, but in patients with other, let's say, with the really chronic and severe myofascial pain syndromes, for instance, when we want to have this muscle relaxing effect, to have this kind of lasting effect on patients, most of the time, including baclofen, patients will need to take this medication multiple times a day because their half-life is relatively short. Whenever we do that, whenever patients take muscle relaxant in the morning or in the middle of the day, when they're naturally getting a little bit more tired, let's say in the second part of the day, adding a muscle relaxant increases this concentration within an hour or two after the patient took the drug. And when the plasma concentration reaches its peak, that's when patients experience more of that drowsiness and fatigue and sedation. So during the daytime, majority of my patients, in my experience, they would typically skip the daytime dose of a muscle relaxant, not to feel tired or groggy throughout the rest of the day, and that actually diminishing the muscle relaxing effect. So when patients take a long-acting muscle relaxant, and I believe Amrix is the only truly extended-release muscle relaxant on the market, maybe in addition to orphenadrin. But with Amrix, patients take, let's say, 50 milligrams at night, and it actually peaks in about 6 hours in the plasma concentration. So if patient takes the medication at 6 p.m., at midnight, you reach the maximum plasma concentration and patients are asleep. So the drowsiness is not going to be an issue. By the morning, they still have therapeutic level in their system, but it's not high enough to really produce extensive or excessive drowsiness. So I've had a lot of success with this medication specifically. But again, not because it's the cyclobenzaprine, but rather because it's an extended release medication. And I would certainly use it only at night. And I've had a lot of luck with this drug.
And what are your thoughts on the other two? The most common ones being Skilaxin and Tizanidine.
I use Skilaxin as well. I think it's a good muscle relaxant. Just it's for some reason it's not my first choice, and I'm totally biased in this. It's just I think that I use way more baclofen. I even use way more cyclobenzaprine and certainly Ambrx than Skilaxin. But I've used it. I think it has a good muscle relaxing activity. It's not as heavily sedating as let's say Tizanidine. Tizanidine I've used in patients with migraine as well, almost like a quote unquote prophylaxis when we have patients take Tizanidine nightly, let's say for a few weeks. And that sometimes has been shown to be beneficial for migraine patients. The same thing we're observing patients with tension type headaches. But again, in my opinion, Tizanidine is probably one of the more sedating muscle relaxants that we have. It's fairly potent, it's very effective, but very sedating. I yet to see probably a patient who would be okay taking this medication during the daytime. There are probably some patients who would, and they're just not sort of they're tolerant or not very sensitive to the sedating side effect. And I've seen those patients, but usually more often than not, patient can take it just fine at night. During the daytime, this is not something that I would prescribe easily for patients because, again, of that sedating potential. There's another drug, by the way, that I also use frequently because it's considered to be least sedating muscle relaxant, just like baclofen. It's called chlorzoxazone. There's a branded name called Lorzone. Chlorzoxazone is an old-fashioned medication. So Lorzone is a newer drug that's branded at this point. And it's a mild muscle relaxant. It's certainly not nearly as sedating as probably any other muscle relaxant on the market. So it works really well for mild cases or patients who are very sensitive to sedation. That's probably one of my muscle relaxants of choice.
So so just to summarize where we are right now. So with tension headaches, just to get, I know we took a deep dive into muscle relaxants, which is, I think, very useful for muscle spasms and pain conditions in general. But so tension headaches typically respond to over-the-counter pain medications, aspirin, Tylenol, NSAIDs being ibuprofen, naproxen, etc. Muscle relaxants, not robust evidence, but you do use them occasionally, for tension headaches. What else can people take for their tension headaches?
So there are actually some studies indicating, and I've seen that in clinical practice, when patients would take triptans like Imitrex, Maxalt, Relpex, those type of medications, and sometimes that would be also very beneficial for them. So a response to triptans, again, doesn't mean that this patient has migraine. A lot of patients tell me this, and a lot of providers ask me, I had this patient, he doesn't have sensitivity to light, he doesn't have nausea, and the pain is kind of rather moderate. It's never really disabling to take the triptan and the pain goes away. It could be just a triptan responder, and he still may have had a tension type headache that responded to triptans. Again, not a strong evidence, certainly not the medications we recommend to use for patients with tension type headaches, but they could be helpful. We typically try to avoid medications such as opioids for tension type headaches two main reasons. First of all, obviously, addiction and risk for medication overuse. And patients with tension type headaches do get medication overuse or rebound headaches if they overuse their rescue medications. And patients typically don't recommend to use anything that contains butalbital for the exact same reasons, such as Furoset, Furanil, those type of medications. They're frequently used, but I feel like they're more frequently prescribed for migraine treatment. Again, elsewhere, I typically don't prescribe these medications and I don't recommend patients with migraine to take butalbital-containing medications because, again, of that dependence potential, because of that risk for medication overuse headache. So those two classes, we strongly encourage providers not to use to treat not migraine, not tension-type headaches.
And if someone wanted to avoid classic medications, even if they are over-the-counter, you did talk about a variety of supplements that someone could use for migraines. Are there any supplements or more naturopathic, natural things they could use for their tension headaches?
Not as much. I mean, I would imagine that we don't have really a lot of information on the supplemental or use of supplements or herbal supplements for tension type headache treatments. Probably not because we believe that they're ineffective, but simply because there are very, very few studies done actually on treatments of tension type headaches, partially because this is not considered to be the most disabling headache condition, although it's very prevalent. Typically, patients manage it with over-the-counter medications, majority of the time, literally. So that's why there's probably not as much attention to tension type headaches at this point.
Any closing thoughts on tension headaches? We've just reviewed the pathophysiology, the diagnosis, and the treatment, and we've also contrasted the differences between tension headaches and migraine headaches, the two most common primary headaches that may affect people.
Well, I would probably just add a couple of other points about prophylaxis, and also a couple of things about non-pharmacological, not maybe supplemental treatment of tension type headaches, but what else could patients do and try besides taking the medication? So if we're talking about pharmacotherapy, again, pharmacological management, prophylactic management, the best class of medication has been shown and proven to be effective in majority of the patients are tricyclic antidepressants. And again, that doesn't mean that tension type headaches is a result of depression or any other emotional disorder. Actually, depression and anxiety are both very prevalent in patients with tension type headaches, especially with chronic tension type headaches. But we shouldn't put in a question mark that these two conditions just different presentation of depression, for instance. It's not correct. But tricyclic antidepressants are broadly used in pain management in general. We use tricyclic antidepressants even now, even this day, in patients with migraine headaches. And it has been shown to be very effective. Specifically, the studies were done on amitriptyline in doses between 25 and 75 milligrams per day. And it has also level A of recommendation in terms of the treatment suggestions for chronic tension type headaches. There's some evidence that SNRIs, such as venlafaxine, could be beneficial for patients. Medications like mirtazapine or Remeron has been shown to be beneficial, but their level, I believe it was level B evidence of recommendation to support their use. As far as the non-pharmacological option.
Wait, what about Effexor?
So Effexor would be probably the same. It's the venlafaxine, essentially. It has this level B evidence that it was actually shown to be beneficial. The dose typically should be in the kind of vicinity of 150 milligrams a day. So it's a rather moderate to the higher end of the dosing range, but it also can be beneficial. Other things, again, that could be very helpful for patients with tension type headaches, obviously, just like with migraines, a trigger avoidance. If we know, for example, that dehydration and skipping meals or irregular sleep is a major trigger for tension type headaches, well, patients need to do something about it and just try to change their lifestyle a little bit so that they actually can eliminate it if there's those avoidable triggers, so to speak. So regular sleep, regular meals, staying hydrated. Those things are really important. I typically recommend all my patients to exercise on a regular basis, at least 40 minutes at a time and at least 3 days a week. Stress management is really important in tension type headaches and things like meditation, relaxation exercises, even physical therapy and some stretch exercises. Those kind of things are very, very helpful as well. There's some evidence that cognitive behavioral therapy or psychotherapy, again, applicable to those patients in whom emotional stress appears to be a big factor, is really, really important. There's some evidence that acupuncture might be beneficial. But out of all of those methods, actually, the one method that has level A recommendation is EMG-guided biofeedback, which is not used nearly as often for some reason. When I was working in Moscow, in Russia, so we're talking about like late 1990s, we actually had a biofeedback department at our medical academy. Or at least we had the headache clinic over there at Moscow, we had a biofeedback setup where patients were encouraged to do biofeedback sessions and treatments. When I was here working in Chicago at my previous job and we had an inpatient unit, all patients were encouraged to participate in biofeedback classes during their hospitalization. And we strongly recommend to use this technique, but again, the very, very few centers, headache centers, are utilizing it. And this is really phenomenal. In fact, I strongly believe that everybody should be able and learn how to do biofeedback. And it's not that difficult to really learn the technique. I do recommend people to go to a special centers and people could actually Google biofeedback, for instance, centers or EMG-guided biofeedback, and they can go and learn this technique. And once you learn how to do it, essentially, you can actually do it on your own or by yourself. You don't have to go to those centers continuously. It's just to learn the technique and then you should be able to do it by yourself. And this is one of the most effective, actually, non-pharmacological treatments that we recommend for patients with tension type headaches.
Are there any biofeedback places that you'd recommend that you're familiar with?
I don't know any specific place per se. I just basically, I usually Google it, based on the patient's location, I can find and recommend some of those. There are quite a few of them. It's just a matter of finding. But the point is that although there are a lot of those biofeedback centers around the country, it's just unfortunate that most of the headache clinics don't utilize this effective therapeutic modality. And actually, it's been shown to be beneficial not only in tension type headaches, but also in migraine. So this is kind of one of those key therapeutic, non-pharmacological therapeutic modalities that could be tried, and yet headache centers are just underutilizing it.
There are different levels of headache centers, so that's why you have your center.
Right. So I definitely, it's something that I strongly encourage. And again, if patients are unable to travel here, we could certainly recommend, we can find the location, recommend something, more close to their location. I usually say that several sessions, maybe five sessions, might be needed for a patient to learn to feel this technique. And what's really interesting, we actually found that pediatric patients, maybe because they use their imagination more freely than adult patients, perhaps, and biofeedback does require imagination and kind of really focusing on your sensation and feelings. I feel like kids frequently learn this technique a lot faster than adult patients, which is kind of really interesting.
So then I have to ask, do you offer EMG biofeedback at your center?
Right now, we just ordered an equipment. So at my previous center, we ordered it. And so we don't order just the EMG guided biofeedback. Actually, there's a different modalities of it. So in tension type headaches indications, EMG biofeedback has shown to be the most beneficial. In patients with migraine, we actually use EMG guided biofeedback, and we use thermal guided or thermal biofeedback when we're actually measuring the body temperature of the palms of the patient of arms before and after exercise. And it's really fascinating. It's actually very eye-opening for the patient as well when they can increase temperature of their hands by just sitting in the chair and not moving a finger. They're able to increase temperature sometimes by a couple of degrees within just 20 or maybe even 15 minute exercise. It's really fascinating.
I feel like that's a whole podcast into itself.
Oh, absolutely. So, and this is something that is not unfortunately used as often as it should be.
Especially if it's a natural way to control your pain or headaches and anxiety. And it's really, I think, putting someone in control of their own body by learning how to, I guess, control their physiology.
That's exactly right.
Any closing thoughts on tension? I don't want to dive into I feel like that should actually be a whole podcast in itself, just because there are not a lot of places that offer it, and especially if you are offering it, that should be an isolated topic. Any closing thoughts on tension headaches then?
Well, tension headaches, just kind of a couple of things to remember, that by far, tension headache is the most common primary headache disorder. It's probably the most common type of headache, period. But it's not the most common type of headache in our clinical practice. And if you see a patient in front of you that you think he has tension type headaches, but yet it's severe enough for them to see a healthcare provider, more often than not, we're seeing a migraineur in front of us, not a tension type headaches, a headache person. So just keep that in mind. Don't assume that all moderate and intensity pain is necessarily a tension type headache. Don't assume that all headaches that originate in the occipital region necessarily cervicogenic headaches in their nature, as that could actually be, might as well be either tension headache or migraine. And always just remember how these headaches impact patients' quality of life, their day-to-day activity. Again, tension type headache appears to be not as disabling in terms of the impact of an acute attack compared to migraine. And again, patients typically would say that routine physical activity does not aggravate their pain, while it does aggravate significantly migraine. And I think this is one of the more important differentiating questions that we could ask. It's really the headache-related disability.
Dr. Firak Stubbs, thank you so much for taking the time to share your insights on tension headaches and also the comparing and contrasting tension headaches to migraine headaches. So we'll continue on with the series in the next podcast.
All right, great. Thank you, Chris. I am really, really excited to be part of this. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe and visit the Get Healthy 360 Facebook page. We are always looking for feedback and new story ideas. Thanks again, and see you next time.